Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is an oncologist who specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Dr. Chu sits down for a conversation with Dr. Marion Mora. Dr. Mora is the chair of the American Cancer Society's National Board of Directors and the author of Choices, one of the first major self-help books for cancer patients.
So, Marion, it's really a pleasure and an honor to have you on our show this evening.
Good evening. I'm really happy to be here, Ed.
You really are one of the kind of founding fathers of the Yale Cancer Center, having been here for well over 25 years. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the experience was like in those early days and what your role was, and take it from there.
I'm happy to do that, Ed. I joined the Cancer Center in 1975, and as you know, Yale was named a comprehensive cancer center in 1974. So I came in early into the fray when we were trying to put together the cancer center and look at what was happening in the state of Connecticut. And my background is in communications and community organizations. So I had the two pieces of work that I was doing there. I was working both on the communication pieces and also looking at the outreach. And one of the things we did early on was to have a major meeting in the state working with the five organizations that were working in cancer at the time, and that is the American Cancer Society, the State Health Department, the Hospital Association, the Medical Society, and Yale and the University of Connecticut Health Center. And we brought together organizations and people in the state who were then working on cancer to try to decide what kind of a program we needed. And several things came out of that. There were a lot of professionals there. It was back in, you have to remember that this was back in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, we were starting to have some successes with chemotherapy. We were having some good successes with radiation therapy. But cancer was still viewed as a death sentence by most people, and there were very little information for patients, lots of information for doctors and nurses, but very little information for patients. And at the time, oncology was a new specialty, and oncology nursing, I don't think we even called it oncology nursing at the time. So it was, we had some nurses who were trained to give chemotherapy under the aegis of the physicians, but most of those people were in the research setting. So Yale had been involved in research and in research in cancer for a very long time. You can contrast that to what's happening today, where we have very well-trained medical teams who are looking at patient care. We have an explosion of information. We have a very active advocacy effort, and we have a growing number of survivors. There are more than 10 million people in the United States today who have survived cancer. And I think that having that many survivors is due to several things. We're doing a lot of prevention and early diagnosis, so we're finding the cancers earlier, and cancer has now become more of a chronic disease right. than of a death sentence.
Yeah, it really is remarkable the advances that you've been part of for
yes.
this 25, 30-year period. An important element that you really played, I think, the key role here at the Cancer Center back in the 70s was the formation of the Cancer Information Service.
Right.
Maybe you can tell the listeners out there what the mission of that service was at that time, and what's the role of that service even today in 2008.
Well, back in the 1970s, when the Cancer Act was passed and the amendments of the Cancer Act in 74 was passed, there was an aegis that we were to give up-to-date, accurate information to patients, their families, the health professionals, and the general public. And it was interesting how it came about. When the National Cancer Institute got the mandate from Congress that they were to do this communications piece, they started looking around and trying to decide what kind of information should be given. And at the time, Ted Kennedy's son had sarcoma.
Right, yep.
And if you remember, at that time, sarcoma was an in most places, an incurable disease. Most of the kids who got it died. And the Kennedys, however, had experience in knowing where the best medical centers were, and they were able to find a medical center that was doing some state-of-the-art treatment in sarcoma. So their son was saved. His leg was amputated, but his life was saved. And the people in NCI said, you know, isn't it, wouldn't it be wonderful if the rest of the people in the United States who don't have access to this kind of care were able to get access to this kind of care? And what can we set up to make this access possible? So they came up with setting up the telephone service, and they decided that they would fund the comprehensive cancer centers, and at the time there were 17 of them, and give them communications contracts, which would part of it would be to set up the cancer information service. Well, that's the 1-800-4-CANCER number, which is still in existence 30 years later. Mm-hmm. The aim of the cancer information service is to give accurate, up-to-date information to anybody who calls.
And who provides the information? Are they volunteers? Are they trained specialists?
It's all paid staff, very highly trained. Quality is a very big issue. At the very beginning, there was a lot of discussion about what kind of a program and what role would the cancer centers have in it. And it was finally agreed that it would be nationally led. It would be regionally, the information would be given regionally, but the information would be nationally led, and it was not to be a PR program for the cancer centers. That mm-hmm. is, you could not decide that your cancer center is treating cancer one way, and thus that's the information you're going to give, but that we would give the same kind of information. Now, back in 1975, there was no internet, there were no fax machines, so it was when we started out, it was a very big job to try to figure out how to get that information and how to give the good, accurate information, how to train people to give it. So the NCI very wisely set up a series of task forces, and the people in the field spent a lot of energies and time setting up the systems, that many of which are still in place. Well, but today, you know, at the time, if the National Cancer Institute had a news release that wanted to give to the 17 centers, it would take them almost all day to call the centers. Wow. And to tell them what the news was. Now, of course,
now with the technology, it's
everybody's
instant.
Using the same computer program, so that the information that people are giving is much more similar today than it was in the past. But it's a wonderful service. It's I think one of the most important things the National Cancer Institute has done in the time that it's been, because I think it's made a real difference. Mm-hmm. It's helped patients to become partners with their doctors in making those really, really difficult decisions that cancer patients have to make every day.
Yeah, no, critically important. And just, I guess, reemphasize the point, you really played the key role in helping to launch the service that was based here at the Yale Cancer Center.
Yes, we were one of the first centers to open our phones, and so we spent a lot of time pulling the information together and making sure that what we got was really up-to-date and accurate, and that is the key words that are still there: credible, accurate, up-to-date information. I think what's interesting is that it's a model that is now being used around the world. Germany was the first country that came to us and said, can we want to set up an information service. As a matter of fact, the German CIS people came to our offices at Yale to see how we were doing things, and they were the first people that set it up. And now there are many countries around the world. As a matter of fact, we have an international cancer information service group where those of us who've been running services Yes. go out and help the new countries who are trying to set up similar services.
Well, in fact, as I was getting ready for our show this evening, I saw that you, in fact, are the founding member of this International Cancer Information Service.
Yes, and I'm serving on their board of directors, and it's very exciting because we have a lot of developing countries who are now doing cancer plans and who are setting up cancer information services, and it's wonderful to see that this is a model that other countries can follow.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. So are those country-specific cancer information services, are they linked and hooked up with say, the NCI, Cancer Information Service, here in the United States? Or are they completely separate?
It depends on what they want to do. In some cases, they are using the same information. In other cases, they're using the publications. Both the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute are part of the international group. So it's really a large give and take, trying to help other people to do what we've done and done very successfully here in the United States.
Now, the American Cancer Society also has their own cancer information service. Is that correct?
Yeah, the American Cancer Society has an 800 number, ACS 2345, I believe it is, that where they give information. They give similar information to what the National Cancer Institute, CIS, is. The National Cancer Institute was set up, maybe 10 or 15 years earlier than the American Cancer Society's 800 number. But it's their services that work very closely together. And we find that we get different people. Some of the same people call us to make sure that each of the organizations is giving the right information. But I think both organizations need to have this kind of service to serve the people that, I mean, there are just many people who need the information, and the phone lines are busy for both organizations.
Right. So over the past 30 years, what changes, what advances have you seen in terms of the way that the cancer information is communicated to patients and their loved ones?
I think to me the biggest change is the sophistication of the people who call. I think people have much more information today than they had when we first started out. A lot of people who call you have already been on the internet and have looked up things and are now trying to make their own decisions about what they're going to do. So there's much more of a helping people to make decisions than there was in the early days. I think the explosion of information has made it more difficult for some people because they get a lot of different opinions that they're trying to figure out what is the right thing for them to do. So I think the people on the phone spend more time trying to help people sort out the issues that are bothering them than they did in the early days. And, of course, the technology is probably what's made the biggest difference. And there's an email now, and there's text messaging, and there's live help, so that there are a lot of ways of getting to the audiences that we didn't have in the early days.
Yeah, I mean, we see this every day in the clinic when we deal with our patients, because they come with printouts that they've gotten off the internet with new treatment approaches for their diseases, at centers all around the country or even in different countries around the world.
And do you think that makes it more difficult for the physicians?
I think, again, I think knowledge is good, information is good, but I think as you kind of suggested, sometimes too much information may not be so helpful.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's harder for them, I think, to really understand the good from the bad. But I think what is helpful is that it opens up lines of communication and dialogue, which I think is really very, very important. And I think the good thing is it empowers the patients and their family members.
Yeah, and I think what we have found is that people who see cancer specialists, the physician doesn't know the patient. It isn't like going to your general practitioner who knows you and understands what you want. When you see a new patient, I'm sure you see this, when you see a new patient, you do not know what the patient needs or what kinds of attitudes they have, whether they want extensive treatment or whether they don't want very much treatment. So I think we try to help the patients know the right questions to ask the physicians. And I think that's another piece that the cancer information does, is try to help the patients to figure out what is it that you really want to ask the doctor and what questions is the doctor the only person who can answer them for you. Because as you know, people don't have very much time with their doctors these days. I think that's another thing that's changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to canceranswers@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC. At this time, we're going to take a short break for a Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about cancer advocacy and the importance of cancer information services with our special guest, Dr. Marion Mora.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm here in the studio with my special guest, Marian Mora, talking about her work in cancer advocacy and patient support. Before the break, Marian, we were talking about the important role of the Cancer Information Services, and maybe for those listeners out there, I'd like to give out two numbers. Marian actually gave them, but just for listeners out there, there's the 1-800-4-CANCER number. That's the NCI Cancer Information Services number. That's 1-800-422-6237. And then the American Cancer Society also has a cancer information service number, and that is 1-800-ACS-2345. And I apologize, I don't have the exact numbers for ACS, but just ACS-2345. So Marian, in addition to providing really important information for patients and their loved ones, I also understand that the Cancer Information Service has a research component to it, and you've played a critical role in that as well.
Yes. You know, working at Yale, and Yale being such a research institute, and having it the National Cancer Institute funding the Cancer Information Service, and the National Cancer Institute is also an important research institute. We were looking early on to see what kind of research we might do in the communications field. And in the beginning, there were a few studies that when a person calls the information service, the person who answers the phones fills out what's called a call record form. And so we knew who was calling us and what information they were looking for, what kind of cancer they had. And so we kept those records. And at the beginning, most of the research we did was looking at what kinds of people were calling us, what questions did they ask, were they satisfied with the information we gave them, so that was what we looked at. And then as we went along, some of the cancer control researchers in the country, Dr. Al Marcus, who was out at the University of California in Los Angeles, who was a research investigator in the cancer control area, was working with one of the Cancer Information Service offices, and he was interested in behavioral research. And his thought was, wouldn't it be interesting if we could do behavioral research across the country in all the Cancer Information Service offices? It was a very ambitious thought. Coming from Yale and its research interest, I was very interested in it. And so he and I worked together and put together a grant that the National Cancer Institute funded, where we started looking at could we change people's behaviors by giving messages at the end of our usual service in the Cancer Information Service. And the big question was, is it possible to do research while you're still giving high-quality service? And that was a question that we had as to whether or not we could actually put a research component into a service environment. Well, it did work out very well. And we had three projects, so we did a randomized trials on three projects where we were looking at what do people do with the information we gave them? Do they actually change their behavior at all? One of the projects was, could we get people to eat more fruits and vegetables? Mm-hmm. And we found out by giving a short message at the end of usual service that we could actually get people to eat more fruits and vegetables during the day. Another project we looked at was how can we use the media to get underserved people to call the Cancer Information Service. Mm-hmm. So there were three projects, and we were able to accrue 6,000 people into the three projects in a one-year area. Now, in doing research, I think you know that it's not easy to accrue people into research projects and to have them then called back and answer all the questions. And so And we did very high quality research. The people on the phone followed the protocols, so the quality of the research was very good. And recently, we were again funded by the National Cancer Institute to do three more randomized trials that are about to get underway that are going to be looking at how do we help people make decisions on both treatment and survivorship issues.
Those are very relevant issues.
And it's become a communications research laboratory across the United States. I think it was an ingenious idea that Dr. Marcus had, and they're very difficult research projects to do. But what he did was to involve the people in the field at the Cancer Information Service offices, so that the people in the Cancer Information Service offices came up with a list of concepts that they were interested in finding out. And then he found some senior investigators who were interested in those same projects. So we married the researchers with the Cancer Information Service people, and it's been a very successful collaboration.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. And along these same lines, you've also been very actively involved, I'm sure in large part because of your background in communications, in writing self-help books for cancer patients. You've had a number of books, but your first one was called Choices, which really was one of the first major self-help books for cancer patients. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I believe strongly that patients, I believe this from the very beginning, that patients should be partners with their physicians in the cancer area, because cancer is still a devastating diagnosis. It's not the death sentence that it was in 1975, but if you talk to any patient, they will tell you they remember exactly the moment when somebody said to them, you have cancer. And it still is. The treatments, although they're not as difficult as they were back in the 70s, are still long-term, and for some people, although we've tried to do well, I think we've done quite well with the side effects, they're still not benign treatments. And so I think it's important for people to understand and to be part of those decision-making with their physicians. And Choices came up in an interesting manner. My sister, Eve Potts, is a medical writer. And when we were putting together the information at Yale to start the Cancer Information Service back in the 1970s, she had a friend who had lung cancer. And her friend would call her two or three times a week with questions about her treatment. And she called her one day and said to her, I haven't slept in 48 hours. I have a terrible sore throat, and I am positive that my lung cancer has grown and is in my throat. And I don't want to call the doctor because I'm positive he's going to give us bad news. So Eve called me, and I said, well, why don't you ask her if she had a radiation treatment recently? Maybe the radiation is causing a side effect that's causing the sore throat. And sure enough, she had. Now, maybe somebody had told her that she could get this side effect from radiation, but she clearly didn't remember it when she needed it. And my sister was raising four kids at the time, and she had a Dr. Spock book on her bedside table so that when something happened in the middle of the night, she could open her book and find the answer to whatever it was that was going on. And she said to me, Marion, why isn't there a Dr. Spock book for cancer patients? And I said, well, I don't know. We had been starting to write some patient material at Yale. We did books that call Chemotherapy and You and Radiation Therapy and You, which are hallmarks in the field, and we gave the rights to the NCI, and they're still being published. But clearly, there was not one book you could pick up and find the answers to your questions. So we found a publisher who was interested in publishing it, and then we decided that we really wanted it to be a book that was told from the cancer patient's point of view, and that we would marry the medical information in with what the cancer patients told us. So we went out and asked patients to please keep track. What questions did they wish they had asked the doctor before they made the treatment decision? What kind of questions that they had that nobody answered in the hospital? People told us nobody would talk to us. Well, that was not true. Patients were very happy to give us their questions. And so the book is a marriage of the mundane and the medical. And it turned out to be an 1,100-page soft-baked
I didn't realize it was that long.
It's a big book. And I'm always surprised when somebody asks me a question, I go in it, and sure enough, the answer is there. We don't even remember having written it. And it's gone through four editions, and it is still one of the major self-help books in the field. And the patients told us, for example, they told us, going into cancer is like going into a foreign country where you don't know the language. I don't even know the questions to ask my doctor. Mm. So we were the first people who put in little boxes that said, here are the questions to ask your doctors. Now, I thought, you know, all the doctors I know are going to kill me because their patients are going to come with their lists of questions. And it was absolutely opposite. The doctor said it was very useful for them to have patients who actually knew the questions that they wanted to ask.
Yeah. No, as we were talking about earlier, I think it really is important to have, a close, careful, intimate dialogue between the physician, the patient, and their loved ones about really important issues.
Yeah, and it's very hard for patients. I have another sister who just has gone through two cancer problems in the past year, and I've gone with her to a lot of her appointments, and you are overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're overwhelmed even when you know a lot, but when you don't know anything, it is a really frightening and overwhelming for people to go to all those appointments and to hear all that foreign language that they absolutely do not understand. And a lot of people are afraid to say to a doctor, hey, stop, I don't know what you're talking about. They don't want to sound ignorant in front of a physician. So we try to make it simple and to help people to figure out what it was that they really wanted to know and needed to know to make a decision.
So I'm just curious, given the fact that you're now involved in the, the International Cancer Information Service and trying to, bring this critical information to foreign lands, have you thought about, or maybe Choices is already translated into foreign languages?
It's been translated into several languages.
Has it?
Yes. And so it's out there. You have a book, you write a book, and then it's like having a child. It goes out and does its own thing, and it's always interesting to see what happens with Choices.
Good, terrific. Well, it's amazing how fast the time has gone, but I did want to congratulate you on your recent appointment as chair of the American Cancer Society's National Board of Directors, which is really a tremendous honor, I think, to mark all of the great achievements you've had in the field of cancer advocacy and cancer care.
Well, I was very honored to be installed in October as chair of the national board. I owe it to Yale and my work at the CIS because I got involved with the Cancer Society because of the Cancer Information Service. My first day at work, my boss said to me, the first thing you need to do is to go out and talk to the people who worked with us and supported the grant that funded the Cancer Information Service. And the first organization was the American Cancer Society. So I went out and visited them at their offices, and the chair of the Cancer Society said to me, well, we need people on our communications committee. I think I need to introduce you to the communications people here. And before I left, I was chair of the communications committee. And that's how I started volunteering for the Cancer Society. And I've been volunteering for them ever since.
Great. Well, terrific. I think, again, it's a tremendous honor and an accomplishment. To remind our listeners out there, the two key numbers, if you want any additional information relating to your cancer or loved one's cancer, 1-800-4-CANCER, 432-6237, and 1-800-ACS-2345. Marion, this has been really tremendous, and I thank you so much for joining us this evening on Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Thank you very much, Ed. It was my pleasure.
So until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, we'll meet Dr. Tom Duffy, the interim section chief of hematology at Yale School of Medicine.